B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. The home stretch for 2019 continues this week. The President's Cup down under in Australia being contested at Royal Melbourne. An Alistair McKenzie Classic that is renowned for having some of the firmest and the fastest greens in the world. Last week, Tiger's tournament in the Bahamas turned into a referendum on Patrick Reed and cheating. We'll discuss this in great detail with the man who was down there, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Also, we have another in our 10 predictive question surveys from a very unique perspective, that of a professional caddy. Kip Henley is a longtime friend of the show, currently on the bag for Stuart Sink. And we'll wrap things up with a revisit of a conversation we had earlier in the fall with former U.S. amateur champ and PGA Tour pro Doc Redman. But we begin with Ron Green Jr. and just the thought of having to go down to Australia to cover the President's Cup. You know, I just can't get past those that did this. I hate the flight 5 hours to L.A. I can't imagine getting off of that plane and then going, all right, let's load up for 16 more. I cannot get behind a trip to Australia. I just can't.
So I don't expect I'll ever go.
Oh, I mean, I was looking at who all was over there covering it. I'm like, I would have had to have spent the better part of the last 6 months in therapy figuring out how to psych myself up to get on those planes.
I know what you mean. I was talking to a buddy of mine, Bob Herrig.
Yeah.
He was in the Bahamas. He was flying home. I said, how do you get there? He says, I fly Tampa, Atlanta, Atlanta, Detroit, Detroit, Los Angeles, Los Angeles, Sydney.
I mean, is death favorable?
And then you got to turn around and make it home.
And that's the worst part, is you get there, and just when you exhale, you've got to do it again. And no. Oh. Well, Ron, let's talk a little bit about the Bahamas. You know, for what should be a relaxing boondoggle for both journalists and golfers, it seems most years has a ton of drama. Now, most of the time it has to do with Tiger Woods and will he or won't he, or how is he and how isn't he not, and all of that. This year there wasn't that, but, oh, God, did Patrick Reed just open up a can of worms?
That was, the simplest little thing just becomes, you should not have done that. And it's just when you think Patrick Reed has moved on past and, you know, sort of all the ripples have gone away and the water's calm and all that. And now this.
You know, the thing is, and I can't get past this, what he does on the golf course, especially in team competition, I love so much about Patrick Reed. I really do. But it's one of these things that when there's this much smoke, eventually there's got to be fire. You have the incident with the wrong scorecard at the University of Georgia that got him kicked out. You have problems with teammates at Augusta State over a couple of years. Then there's this. Ron, when there's this much smoke, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, at some point we have to call it a duck.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, he sort of walks around, you know, he's not exactly Hester Prynne wearing the scarlet letter, but I mean, he walks around with, you know, I mean, there's an image now, there's a reputation, it precedes him. I think when you look at him and, you know, he's the whole Captain America thing, but, you know, is that who you want as is the face of your national team? Right now, that's pretty awkward.
Do you think if we weren't going to Australia, if it was someplace closer, do you think that there is a possibility that Tiger Woods would have said to him, this ain't happening, you're not going?
I don't know. I think he could have passed on him earlier and didn't. I'm sure... Maybe the question came up. I don't know. I think they were so locked in then, and you've got obvious travel issues and who's going to go and all this stuff. I just would love to know deep down if Tiger had to just roll his eyes and just grit his teeth like, you got to be kidding me. This now, you know, there's so much to it. And, you know, it didn't help things. I don't think that Justin Thomas goes in the bunker, throws the ball down there and asks Patrick Reed if this is the way you do it and starts scraping the sand away. I know he's trying to be funny, but it's sort of like, I don't know, that seemed to hit a wrong note to me. But it's just maybe every sport needs that guy. I mean, certainly Patrick Reed is that guy in golf. You know, Ian Poulter was loud and cocky and, you know, the preening peacock and all that. But he didn't do anything wrong. That was just personality. Reed, you just keep, I mean, there's, you know, it's layered in there like, you know, like a James Lee Burke novel. All these more layers of darkness that there are things, potential darkness that just, you know, they don't help him. And, you know, I had a nice chat with him down there about something in the Bahamas last week, and it was, you know, it was fun to talk to. He's been great with the media. I give him credit. He stands right up there, even the President's Cup, and answers all this. What the part I don't get is, you know, and initially it came off like he was a victim, like, hey, they gave me this two-stroke penalty. Well, you committed this violation. It's evident. You know, he tried to spin it a little bit, and I just have still not gotten any sense of remorse from it. And I just think that's the part that really bothers me.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest, Taking Dead Aim. You know, there are a lot of people, Ron, who still have never gotten over Vijay Singh's infraction years and years, decades ago. These kind of things just seem to pop up with Patrick Reed. Is it something that people are just going to shrug their shoulders and go, that's just who he is? Or is this the kind of albatross in the game of golf that he will never be able to overcome?
Well, I mean, I'm not the first guy to say it. I think Jaime said it the other day on TV. He said, you know, people are going to remember this. I think it will be the kind of thing, you know, Saturday afternoon when he's out there in contention at a tournament and somebody's had a few too many beers there. And, you know, it's going to come up. People are going to throw it out there. And, I mean, good for Cam Smith, the international player, for, you know, he just went straight up, you know, and I mean, he said he called him a cheater. Now, that's a big step. You know, as Patrick Reed says, the difference in breaking a rule and cheating. I think, you know, that sounds like some of the defensive being offered in our current political argument. But, you know, it's I think Patrick Reed, if I'm a endorser, if I'm a sponsor, that's not somebody I want to tie my brand to. I know he's got a new line of clubs coming out. He's getting ready to introduce them in January. And, you know, there would be a bit of a backlash. I think I think people are going to squirm when they're watching him in the President's Cup and some other things. This may eventually pass. Maybe he, you know, gets past it. I don't know. But I think for a lot of people, he's branded now.
Before we get to golf in the Bahamas, let's talk about other things in the Bahamas that I found interesting. Specifically, the constant showing of the marina. Where they were at Albany, and they kept focusing on Tiger's boat. And you've seen Tiger's boat. It's not exactly, you know, a lifeboat. It's a good-sized boat. But parked next to what he was, it made it look like Judge Smales' dinghy from Caddyshack. There were some unbelievable pieces of property in that marina. Did you just sort of stroll around at any time and go, wow, look at this?
There's a lot of people with a whole lot of money, obviously, to have the boats they have, their ships, yachts, whatever you want to call them. And one reason I think they show that marina is, frankly, there's not much around Albany. I mean, the golf course sits there not on the water. And, I mean, it's nice and pretty and works well for that event. But I've walked around it 6-8 times. And I can't remember one hole from the other. They all sort of look the same to me, which, you know, I mean, it's an interesting place. It's not on the water. It's not, you know, in a big population center, which is part of the allure, I think. You know, I know Justin Rose lives there, and I think he's got a great view of the water and all that, but it's interesting what is there or what's not there. It just sort of sits out there, and part of it, I think, is you can get away and not be bothered by anything, but they've got those condos there, and that's sort of, you know, they're sort of, you can see those on the horizon from a long way. Where I was staying was about probably 10 miles away, and I could see them in the distance just because the whole place is flat, and I happen to be on a high floor. But
it's funny that you mentioned that it's not sitting on the water, because that was something that caught my eye, and what it reminded me of, and I don't know if you've ever been there or you may have seen it on TV, there's a golf course in Aruba where they once did a Shell's Wonderful World of Golf between Nick Price and Payne Stewart that is way away from the water. It sits like up in a mountainous area in Aruba, and it is, you know, it is nowhere near the water, but it, to me, it had that same kind of feel of, okay, we're on an island, but we're nowhere near the water. It was that kind of golf course.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's so flat. There's not really much. There's a little bit of elevation change. You know, it sort of rolls. I wouldn't call anything a hill. There's some dunes and everything. But it's just, I would assume there's a real estate component into why they didn't at least put a hole or two out near the ocean. Like when you go to Mayakoba, there's at least a hole, a par three, that plays out right onto the beach. Here, there's none of that. I mean, you could, I don't want to say you could think you're in Florida, but it's sort of like an inland golf course. And, you know, it has, where do you want to call it, lakes, ponds, lagoons, whatever. It has that. But interesting place there. And, you know, obviously very nice. I mean, it doesn't have an elaborate clubhouse. I mean, it's small but functional. It doesn't need, you know, the winged foot clubhouse thing. But it's a, you know, it's very much a boutique-y kind of place. I find it interesting. There's some really nice big houses that sort of sit on one back corner of the golf course there. They're not near the water, not near the ocean. They have no view of anything but a fairway that could, you know, could be any number of fairways. And but that's where some people have chosen, not probably to make their primary home, but to spend some of their disposable income on a second or third home.
Well, why not if you've got it? Rod Greed Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. The golf itself, this tournament's always kind of interesting to me in that you definitely see guys who haven't touched a club in a while, and they're knocking off some competitive rust. But then you see some things, and it sort of catches your eye. I thought Tiger looked really, really good, especially off the tee. It was the same Tiger, essentially, that we saw in Japan earlier, and, you know, looked great. But, you know, it seemed like, in the commentary the first couple of days even, that everyone had sort of written off Henrik Stenson. Oh, he's switched the 3-wood out. Oh, he's getting up into his 40s now. And, you know, all of a sudden Henrik Stenson looked like Henrik Stenson and played some great golf on the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of places or players to look at down there, and he was not the first, second, or third guy you were going to look at. I think he was actually in on a sponsor exemption, and suddenly there he is being Henrik Stenson again. I mean, you know, there was Rose and Ricky being back, and Tiger, and all the guys you would look at wondering what Spieth is going to do, but Stenson just played beautifully and can still get it done. I don't think he probably plays to the consistency level of consistency he once did at the top end, but I mean, he can still. There will be weeks when he can still very much be a factor, and he's the kind of guy now. I think major championships will be what really gets his attention, but. You know, then other guys, you just, you know, the great curiosity down there, among other than watching Tiger, was what does Bryson DeChambeau look like now?
Oh my gosh,
there's a lot of him.
Where did that come from? And that, I mean, the two freakiest things I've seen physically in the last 6 months is Phil dropped 20 pounds in apparently 24 hours, and Bryson DeChambeau put on 20 to 30 pounds in roughly the same amount of time. Bryson looks like Eric Olson out there.
I mean, if I tried to eat what he must be eating, I don't think he would be converted in that way.
No.
But, you know, he said he was making this commitment to get bigger and bulkier and stronger. He's trying to get, you know, 5 miles per hour or more club head speed to hit it even longer. And he certainly chased his body. I mean, that's, you know, we saw Tiger do it some. We saw Rory to some degree. Then they scale it back some. I don't know. That's a risky. It's a risky thing. I mean, Bryson obviously has well thought out reasons, scientific and mental, for why he wants to do it. But, I mean, I can go all the way back to the years when Johnny Miller could have had his swing going away because he was working on his ranch and lifting all this wood and everything, got stronger, you know, built up his upper body and it changed his swing. You know, you look at players, I think of Colonel Peterson, when he decided to lose a lot of weight, suddenly his game went away. His swing wasn't the same. I've often thought that Michelle Wee outgrew her golf swing. She got so tall that her golf swing changed, and she spent
most of her career chasing it and had some injury issues. So, you know, Bryson has decided to do it. We'll see where we are. I mean, it's hard not to notice him now.
Ron Kreitschuger with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. One name that to me is a great curiosity, especially in the first quarter of the golf season heading into the Masters. I'm going to be fascinated to see where we are with Jordan Spieth. Statistically, he had his best putting year he has ever had last year, Ron. That better than 15, and he got nothing out of it because his long game is just so terrible. What did you see out of Jordan Spieth?
Well, just think of where Jordan Spieth would have been last year had he not putted well.
Yes, he'd be with me and you.
And so I'm interested the same way. I mean, I flashed back to walking with him, listening to him at Sony when he played in Hawaii last year, and said, you know, he was close to getting it back. He was very excited. He knew what was going to happen that week, but he was gaining on it. And here we are a year later, and it's almost, you know, playing it playback for it, because I think he's still chasing it. He said down there, Palma said it's getting closer, but he still hits an occasional wayward tee shot that gets him into trouble. And, I mean, like most people, I really, really would love to see him get it back and be Jordan Spieth again, because he brings so much to the game. He's fun to watch, the way he plays, the way he lets us in while he's playing. But, you know, I mean, we keep, you know, sooner or later, you got to show us. And so far we hadn't seen what we've been hoping to see. And I'll be interested to see, like you, how much he plays early in the season and what kind of results he has.
You know, I was thinking a lot about him when he wasn't being shown, and I was like, this just can't be good. Is he in danger? Now, David's was different because David's body fell apart and the swing followed afterward. Is he in danger of getting into David Duvall land, where he becomes this player who was so great and then fell down the rabbit hole and couldn't find his way back?
I don't see that happening right now. I mean, you know, he had a stretch of, I want to say, three straight top tens late summer last year, maybe top 15. So he, you know, it was close. I think he is, you know, he's so young still. I mean, we sort of think he's, you know, a 35-year-old guy. He's not. I think he, if he gets through this, it would be interesting to see what kind of long-term effects it has on him, if it just makes him even stronger, or if it leaves him wondering if it's ever going to happen again. I just think he's got so, you know, there's a lot of scar tissue there already. You know, and then you watch a guy like Justin Thomas who, you know, just shows up back out there, and, you know, Tiger Woods makes the very smart captain's decision to play with the best player on the American team. And it looks easy for Justin, and it just looks hard for Jordan. And I hope we will see him win a tournament this year, but I'm not sure if you were in Vegas that you'd be taking that as you'd be betting on that side of it.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. This was Ricky Fowler's first tournament back since the mishap that was his honeymoon. How much ribbing was he taking for his stomach issues on his honeymoon from players and press that are his friends alike?
Well, I think he clarified it, that he actually didn't get sick till he got home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all the stories were it was his honeymoon, but then he said, no, I was home for a week and was getting ready to start, and I ate something and got sick at home. And so it threw him off. But you know, it was nice to see him back. You know, I mean, he's gone 3 months from tournament golf. And so, I mean, he's a guy who you just, you know, everybody likes, and yeah, adds a little something when he's there, but didn't have a great week at the Bahamas, but you know, I think he's a guy who's got a lot to show next year too. I mean, he won in, I guess, what was it, Phoenix last year, but didn't have a great year beyond that. And you know, whether it was you or somebody else said, do you think Ricky Fowler has underachieved? I'm like, hadn't thought of it that way, but I think he's due to win a couple tournaments. I think that's very important for him going forward.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And when we return, Stewart Cink's man on the bag, Kip Henley, takes Dead Aim at the 2020 golf season with 10 predictive questions, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos. Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Kip Henley is a longtime friend of the show and a very successful PGA Tour caddy. Currently, he's on the bag for Stewart Cink, and I had the chance to pick his brain with 10 predictive questions for 2020 earlier this week. All right, Kip, your perspective is so interesting being a caddy on tour. I cannot wait to hear what you have to say with some of these. I always start the survey with a Tiger Woods question, and this one goes like this. Will Tiger Woods break the tie with Sam Snead for career tour wins this year? And if so, do you think he does it before or after the Masters?
I think he'll get him. He don't play in nothing. What is he playing this year, L.A.?
I figure he'll play L.A. and maybe Arnold and then the TPC, maybe.
He's not doing San Diego.
Well, I forgot about Torrey. Okay, so he'll do Torrey, L.A. I can't imagine. Maybe he does Honda, but I doubt it. He'll do Bay Hill and then TPC. So I guess maybe he plays four times before the Masters.
I'd say he'll have old Sam tied or beaten by the Masters.
Wow.
I'll have him. He one more to beat him, right?
Right. One more beats him.
Yeah, I say by the Masters or the Masters, he'll get him. He'll have a win in one of those first five events. I've always been a Tiger fan, man.
You know, I don't anticipate that the aura, the mystique is the same as it was, you know, between 99 and 2000, and I don't expect that. But is there some of that that is a little bit back on tour, that when he walks out there, people now have to pay notice again? Do you notice that?
Yeah, no doubt about it. With him winning the Masters and stuff, and, I mean, he was threatening to win the Hero, didn't he? I mean, he was up there for a while. And he just ain't playing any golf. If he plays a stretch lead up something, he's just so good. I mean, it's like, if, you know, same as Nicklaus when he was at the very, very, towards the very end of his, when he was really super competitive, you know, when he showed up. You know, Nicklaus started playing ceremonial golf pretty fast, really, in his, like, pretty much early 40s.
Right.
He was, he pretty much said, I'm not, you know. He just play a handful of times a year, and then when he won in '86, he had been completely written off, hadn't he?
So yeah.
I think it's a lot more like when Nicklaus was probably 37 or 8 or something like that. Probably, you know, they both never played a lot of events.
Well, this next question may hit a little too close to home, but I'll ask it anyway. Which is more likely to happen first? Jordan Spieth wins again, or Jordan Spieth parts ways with Greller, as eventually all caddies take the blame for lack of success?
I don't see Greller getting there. They're just such good teammates. And Jordan is such a level-headed guy. I mean, it wouldn't be the end of the world if Jordan rents Greller. But, I mean, you know, like you said, it's part of our gig. But I think he's a sharp enough cat to where he's not going to ever lay the blame on Greller at all. If he lays the blame on Griller, then that means Griller gets all the credit or a lot of the credit for him winning. And I don't think I think that Jordan will win again. He'll figure it out. He still has those streaks of that putter that's crazy. That he just seems to hoop those 20 and 25 footers that other guys don't do when he's really rolling, man. He does it a lot.
PGA Tour caddy Kip Henley is our guest taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for 2020. Last year, I asked if Brooks Koepka was more likely to build off his major championship success or have that chasing appearance fees hangover that we see so often. Obviously, he was great. Number of majors that Brooks wins this year, and I'll set the number at 1.5.
Well, I'll go under. I mean, good Lord, it's so hard. There's only four of them. So, I mean, the guy's incredible, but you can't go. Well, you should put it at one.
So if it was one, you might take a push?
I'd still go with the under because it's just so damn hard to win one, man. He's incredible what he does in these majors and anything he gets suited up for, man. He's in there to whomp them, but it's just so hard to win one. I'd say I go way under on the one and a hook.
Even though he's not going to tee it up again until Torrey Pines, do you think it's a sooner rather than later situation that Rory overtakes him as number one?
I would go with sooner, really.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a huge Koepka fan. Boy, Rory has absolutely found his leg, you know. And I mean, that guy's ball striking and far hitting I think Brooks is definitely, obviously, this is everybody knows this, but Brooks is obviously a way better putter, but if Rory puts anything close, I mean, we got paired with him 1 year at China, and he birdied like 8 out of the first 13 holes playing with me and Brian Gay, and I was like, this is at the beginning of his career, and I went, holy cow, I mean, this guy should birdie every hole. He was so far and so straight and so solid and 10 high all the time. I mean, the guy, I think Rory's really found his legs this year, so I look for him big things. And he's such a likable guy. You hear all his interviews on Patrick Reed, everything. The guy spins stuff pretty positive, man. I like him.
Here are the four major sites this year: Augusta National, Harding Park, Wingfoot West, and Royal St. George. Are we more likely to have first-time winners at these major championship venues, or do you think will we have a year where there'll be more major champions just padding their resume with another?
You got to think, it's just so hard to put your name on one of those major trophies, you know, and it's so even that much harder for a middle run guy to put his name. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just so hard to speak up and get a major because of the pressure that is applied and the heat that's so extraordinary now. So they all set up just for the pure pressure of a repeat guy, you know, a guy who's found a way to get it done. But I'm curious about that Harding Park, how that'll go. That'll be fun. I'll be, unless I don't make it with Stewart Cink, I'll be at Royal St. George, so that should be fun. And then Wingfoot, I hope we get up to there. I mean, that's one of the few courses I've never played in my life that I'm somewhat interested in.
It's one of those that looks harder than hell.
Yeah, it does. There's just like no bad pictures or any comments of Wingfoot ever. Everything's always incredible. So Wingfoot and Shinnecock, those are the two that are off my list. I've played just about all of them that I'm curious about playing. Bandon Dunes, you're hearing tons of great stuff. But I went off on a tangent there on you. But I say more likely the same guys have won or more likely to win again.
Professional tour caddy and my life coach, Kip Henley, is our guest taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for 2020. Here's three young guys I want to talk to you about. Colin Morikawa, Victor Hovland, and Matthew Wolf. Of those three guys, and they all came out on the scene like gangbusters last spring, of those three guys, which is the first do you think will win a major?
Probably, if I had to guess, I would guess. I'm going to say Hovland. He just seems to have that little bit more of the ick factor. I mean, I think the guy with the crazy swing will have trouble. I just don't see his action being – I don't know how he is. This is talking off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I got paired with him, but his action – I just don't see his action lending well to being a great wedge player. I'd be curious to see if he's a great wedge player or not. Because, you know, wedge players are more, you know, waist high when you're hitting those half wedges and stuff. And his action just doesn't set up so great for that. But that Morikawa, the best action comes from Morikawa. I mean, that guy, he's got that little arched left wrist. I mean, those guys drive it dead straight every time. I mean, his action is flawless, almost flawless. But Hovland seems to have a little bit more of the I'll kick your butt attitude out there, you know.
This is so interesting because most of us, and I'm talking about the great unwashed in the world of golf, we tend to focus on the long game so much and how far someone hits it or how far they can hit their irons or this or that. And your conversation about these three guys came down to one thing, their wedge action. Because when it comes to winning on tour in general and winning majors specifically, it's that short game. Everybody's going to miss greens. It's how you can get yourself up and down the most.
Yeah, no doubt. And, I mean, really and truly, that, you know, that 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 yards in there, too, is so darn important. You know, not to throw rocks at Cookie. Cookie's got an incredible game. You know, the boy I worked for last, awesome. But definitely the hole in his game was once we got inside 100 yards, he just wasn't as effective as he should be, you know. Most of those guys that play around and you know, come in shallow, attack shallow, and exit shallow, they're not the best wedge players, but in my opinion. And I don't think that lends well to being great. But if you're not stuffy, you know, when I caddied for Brian Gay, the guy couldn't fly at 249 yards a day. That's exactly what he flew at. But from 80 yards, it was like he was hitting 40-foot putts. I mean, that ball was going and running around the hole and spinning up around the cup and bouncing up and almost going in all day, every day. It never got – he didn't have any off days with his wedges, none. He had all – he had good or great. And that's what the tour players do. Their short games are good or great. But his wedge game was almost great or great every single day. It was no hole.
I have a feeling I know how you're going to answer this question based on a previous answer, but I would need to ask it anyway. On the subject of majors, John Rahm, Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele, and Bryson DeChambeau. These are the four guys in the top 10 right now in the overall world golf rankings without a major on their resume. This year, could you see one, some, or none winning a major?
Of those five, I'd say that's pretty safe. I think one of those guys would get a major.
I know you're high on Schauffele. I think you played with him not long ago, and you told me you loved his game.
Oh, yeah, I love his game, and I love his attitude, and I love his caddy. His caddy's brilliant and hardworking. And, but, I mean, DeChambeau, he's got the it, you know. He's coming to be. He don't think he should win. He knows he should win, you know. And there's a difference, you know. A guy thinking, I think I can win, or, you know, they try and convince themselves. He knows he can win. So, and you said a couple other names that are just studs.
Rahm and Cantlay and...
I mean, Rahm, what kind of years is he having now? And he just won that big old giant $5 million purse. And I watched him three putt the other day on television, wherever they were at, from about 30 feet. And he just tapped it in and walked to the next green. So I guess, you know, in the old days, that putter was going across the knees and slamming and throwing and kicking. So I guess a lot of money sort of changed the way he approaches things. And if his attitude was ever as good as his caddy wanted to be, he would have done this way sooner. So I look for that guy to do some big things. His action is so simple.
Kip Henley's a professional tour caddy, our guest taking Dead Aim, 10 predictive questions for 2020. This guy's just fallen out of the top 50 for the first time, I feel like, in my lifetime. Number of victories for Phil Mickelson on tour this year, and again, I'll set the number at 1.5.
I'm going to go under, but I bet he gets one.
There's just something about him. Every time you count him out, he's going to sneak up and win a pebble on you.
Yeah, man, the guy's still doing so many things. That, you know, he's trying anything and everything to stay relevant. And he's still working hard at it. He's getting up there in his age. But, man, his clubhead speed, I mean, you see him on the range and he's doing those speed sticks and stuff, and he's whistling that club around 100 miles an hour. I mean, the guy's he's an amazing cat. Big Mickelson fan here.
Now, Kip, he's going to turn 50 at the U.S. Open this year. And so sort of a side note, how many senior tour, PGA Tour senior majors do you see him participating in this year?
I'd be shocked if he played more than like two of them. He's not ready to walk off in the sunset yet. I'd be shocked if he played more than two.
In 2016, all we heard about was how the Olympics weren't important and golfers were kind of with reasons and excuses not to play in it. This year, how big a deal do you think it's going to be for the top players to openly pursue spots on their country's rosters?
I'm so uninformed. Where's it even at?
Tokyo.
Yeah, it'll be a way bigger deal. You know, they were a lot afraid of travel and stuff and not knowing what was out there. But then the Olympics was turned out to be a great thing, didn't it? And what, I mean, what's cooler than say I won a gold medal for my country?
Yeah.
You know, you got Sabatini.
He switched countries.
Yeah, he switched countries on us. He's in South Africa, and now because of American values, he's Ukrainian or whatever.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if some of these guys might find a girlfriend that lives in Peru or something, so I'd be on the Peru team. It's going to be a way bigger deal.
Hey, Kip, this is interesting to me, and you're on the range, and you're out with these guys all the time, and I keep thinking on the periphery that the drumbeats are getting louder on this. In 2020, would you be more surprised if the powers that be in golf started to make moves towards bifurcation in terms of equipment, or more surprised if they didn't?
I don't know. I'm such a non-club freak and stuff and pay attention to that. I don't know. No, I don't know. No good opinion.
Is it a bigger deal to all of us on the periphery than it is the guys that are out there?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, no doubt. It's way more important to us. And there's a handful of things that just get poked around all the time, but the golf fans seem to. I mean, there's a handful of guys where, you know, that it would be, but for the most part, it's just like, just get out of the way. Let me do my job.
Kip, true or false, America takes back the Ryder Cup at Whistling Straits?
True.
There we go.
True, for sure. And then I've put it on my new man, Stuart Sink. I said, Stuart, I got two jobs for you. And he's such an unbelievable cat. I always knew he was a good guy. People know Stuart is a good human. But I swear, every day I'm around him, I think he's even more of a good human. But I put two things on him, Charlie. I said, I've never caddied, 15 years, I've never caddied on a team event. And, you know, the President's Cup or the Ryder Cup. And I said, I want you to fix that for me, Stuart. And he said, you got it. We'll do that. And the other thing we've committed on for Stuart Sink to have the greatest career anybody's ever had after the age of 45. I mean, my guy is, he's getting back in. His wife got a lot of her health back. You know, his boys are raised and gone out of the house. He's more focused in his last couple of years than, you know, he had an injury and that set him back a little bit, but now he's healthy and he's got more time on his hands and his wife loves to travel with him and stuff. Old Kip's just gotten so lucky and signed on with this guy. So hopefully my man will take off really fast and make that team. You know, that guy made six straight Ryder Cup teams. Do you know that?
He was on quite a run for a long time.
Yes, he was. And I'm praying he gets back on another one.
Well, I tell you what, we'll just let that go as your gut prediction, your bonus question for anything. Your gut prediction is your man is going to make the Ryder Cup team.
Well, yeah. That's
yeah.
That's what we're out there for. Heck yeah. So, I mean, him and his swing coach have fixed his golf swing. You know, Stuart spent the last 5 or 6 years, you know, I wasn't giggling at him, but we'd be on the range, and that would be whoever's bag I was on. And you'd watch down, you look at Stuart, who still was having great finishes with his technique. But I said he looked like his fall through, like he was a high school kid, you know, trying to make the high school golf team his pitcher for the annual. He's tilted way back with his weight on his back foot, you know, like crazy. And I would go, how does this guy play? And, I, you know, being 6'4 and powerfully strong, that let him get away with murder with that action. But him and his coach, they made a plan that when he got healthy at the middle of this year to stop that action, to start to turn and get to his left foot on his finish. And so, and man, he's got it now to where he does it 95% of the time on the golf course. And he's got a 2 or 3 more weeks in the off season to completely fix it. And he says he's going to, but man, he's hitting these flat bombs off this tee now. He's getting yards, you know, back to what he should be hitting it. And Uncle Kip just signed on right at the perfect time, man. And the guy putts like he's 16 still. It's amazing. But I mean, I get me some sunglasses. The future looks good if I can just hang on to this horse.
He's one of my favorite people in golf, Stuart Sink's caddy, Kip Henley. And up next, we revisit a conversation from earlier this fall as we'll take dead aim with former Clemson Tiger, U.S. Amateur Champ, PGA Tour Pro, and North Carolina's own Doc Redmond. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Hey, we're taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Doc Redmond is a North Carolina boy, former Clemson Tiger, former U.S. Amateur Champion, and current PGA Tour Pro, and it was great to talk with him earlier this fall. Doc, let's start with your amateur career here in the Carolinas. You're from the Raleigh area. You had an outstanding high school career, All-State 4 years, state champion your senior year. I was a little surprised, looking up your history, that you chose to go out of state to Clemson. What went into the decision for you to eschew some of the teams that I know were after you, especially locally where you lived in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area?
Right, yeah. I just, kind of visited a lot of different places and thought that Clemson was going to be the best place for me. And, I just happened to be out of state, and so that's where I went.
Now, before we get to, and it was a short college career, but before we get to that, your plan going into college, was it from the start, I don't plan on being here long, or were you going to play it by ear, or what was your plan when you went to Clemson?
No, I mean, I was thinking about just going 4 years and then seeing how I was playing, after I graduated. Nothing had ever come up about leaving early, or, I guess I never really thought about potentially playing that well and having opportunities to leave early. So, it just happened to work out like that, and it was very surprising.
Doc, with just about every other sport, whether it be, football, basketball, baseball, and you talk to people who go from high school to college, college to pro, with each increasing level, they talk about how the game is so much faster and everybody is so much better, the speed of the game. Obviously, golf is not a speed game. That's hard to compare. But it seems to me, based on your results, you went out and won twice as a freshman playing for Clemson. And we see so many people coming straight out of high school and having success in college, and people coming right out of college and having success immediately in the pros. Why is it that golf doesn't appear to have that same learning curve, or does it?
No, I think it definitely does have that learning curve. Every time you go up a level, the courses get more difficult and the competition's, a whole lot more well-rounded and a lot more consistent. And I did the best to prepare myself in high school by playing, as high-level amateur events as I could and trying to play the best competition I could. So then my transition to college would be much easier and I wouldn't be as surprised by the things I saw. So I think, that helped a lot. But then I also put a lot of work in when I was in college and that speaks a lot to it. But then, there's definitely a huge transition when you get to pro golf, I'd say. I think, this past summer, a lot of guys have had a lot of success, which is kind of an anomaly, but definitely speaks to, how guys are getting a lot better, a lot younger, and how college is doing a great job preparing people.
NJGA alumnus, former amateur champion and professional golfer Doc Redmond is our guest taking Dead Aim. I want to talk with you about the 2017 U.S. Amateur, because that's really where you caught my eye. And before we talk about what you were able to do at Riviera, I want to talk about some of the field. In terms of the amateurs in the field, you faced Doug Gim in the finals. Braden Thornberry was in that field, and he was at the time number one or number two in the world. Joaquin Niemann was in that field. Again, he was number one or number two in the field. That was a stacked U.S. amateur in terms of competition. You'd had success, obviously, at the college level, but even so, did you sort of look around and go, wow, check out this locker room?
No, I don't think I did, but I just knew, I played well at the Western Am the week before then against probably mostly a similar crowd. And so I know I could have success in that same thing, but I think it's always really special to get to play some like a USAM just because it is a culmination of all the best amateurs in the world, and you really get to see how you stack up.
Was that the first time you had indeed qualified for the Am, or had you qualified before?
I think that was the first time, yeah.
Wow.
So that was, it was really exciting for me. You know, I was excited to be there and try and just play well. And the stroke play didn't go the way I wanted to. But then I was kind of rejuvenated, get into match play in the playoff, and I knew that I could make a run.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So, you know, this is Riviera, which is no pleasure cruise on any given day. This is Riviera, though, that's set up by the USGA. So this is one tough mother of a golf course. You mentioned the stroke play, of course, is the part of the U.S. Amateur, the first two or three days of competition. And you finished 62nd out of the 64 qualifiers. How much were you sweating getting into match play? How close did it really come?
I wasn't sweating at all because I thought I had missed when I finished stroke play. I was really disappointed coming off the course and just thought I'd missed. So I think I finished in the morning wave, so I had all afternoon, and I was just like, I'm going to put my phone down, not look at it, and not really worry about it, and ended up going to a Dodgers game and just kind of chilling. And was lucky enough to get into a playoff, to get into match play, and that kind of gave me new life.
Oh, I'm going to call bull here. You didn't check your phone that whole time? Curiosity didn't get you that whole time?
For a solid 3 hours, I would say, I didn't check the scores.
Wow.
Until it started getting down to it, just because, as you know, with golf, things can change on a hole-by-hole basis, and I just didn't want to put that anxiety on me. Whatever happens would have happened.
Hey, he got to start playing NJGA here in the Carolinas. Former U.S. Amateur Champ Pro Golfer Doc Redman, our guest, taking dead aim. So you get into match play. Earlier in the show, I had Jack Keith on. He's a senior at Charlotte Catholic, outstanding amateur golfer, going to be playing at San Diego State next year. Just won the PGA Junior this summer. And he was 5-under through his last five holes, including birdieing the 18th to win by a stroke. And we were talking about, it's one thing to get in the zone. And for every golfer, the zone's a little different. But when you get in the zone, it's fantastic. But to get in the zone at the biggest possible moment, under the biggest pressure, it has to be an unbelievable feeling. And the final with you and Doug Gim at that U.S. Amateur on Riviera, I talked with Curtis Strange immediately afterward. We both thought it was some of the best golf we'd ever seen. We couldn't believe the shots that you guys were making and how surgically you were taking apart the back nine at Riviera. But, Doc, the way you finished, how did that feel in the moment, or were you so locked in you didn't give yourself a chance to feel it?
Yeah, I think I was almost, like you said, so locked in. I didn't get a chance to feel it. I was just focusing on the next shot and doing the best I could, but I wasn't really thinking about the big picture.
The playoff begins at the 10th at Riviera, arguably the greatest and most famous short par four in the world. Did you have a strategy playing that hole every time that you were going to follow, or were you going by feel? How did you play the 10th hole at Riviera?
I played it. I went for it every day just because I thought that took a really big number out of play, honestly. You know, laying up, especially to that back right pin, is that wedge shot's extremely difficult, and you probably have, you know, a 3-foot circle to land it in if you have a wedge in there. And I just thought, you know, getting up there, you can potentially hit the green, but definitely get it in a bunker, just chipping up. And I thought that kind of took double or anything out of play. So I was just blasting it up there.
And I kind of felt bad, and I don't know if that's really the phrase you would use, but it was such a great match, and Doug hit the only bad shot he really hit the whole day was on the tee shot there at the 10th at Riviera. He missed it in the one place he really couldn't, and the match was over right then and there. You won the U.S. Amateur, obviously, but gosh, was there a part of you that hated to see it end like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was tough. You don't want it to end like that. I think it would have been great if we'd both had birdie putts there and it kind of come down to that. We'd both played so extremely well for 36 holes leading up to that. But, you know, it's just that hole's tough. And, you know, left's not good, like you said, but also to that right pin, right's not good. It's just a tough hole, and I definitely feel for him. And it easily could have gone the other way, though, you know?
He's one of ours, got his start playing NJGA events here in the Carolinas. Former U.S. amateur champ and professional golfer Doc Redman is our guest taking Dead Aim. You then make a decision that has really come to light in terms of a rule change this year. But I'm just curious what the mindset is and what goes into it. You remained amateur and kept your amateur status through the first part of 2018 to play in the Masters, as is your right, being a finalist at the U.S. Amateur. I think it's every American boy's dream to play in the Masters. But then you choose to turn pro, not having really any status whatsoever. You're just going to be going off exemptions to try to make your way onto the PGA Tour, and thereby gave up your automatic exemption into the U.S. Open and into the Open Championship. What went into your thinking there, and was there a part of you that said, nah, I want to go ahead and stay amateur at least through the Open?
Yeah, I think, I played the week before the U.S. Open at Memorial as a pro, which was a great opportunity, and then just the opportunity to play the U.S. Open as a pro by qualifying, I think, had a lot of benefits. And I was just thinking that, my career is going to hopefully be a lot bigger than one U.S. Open. And hopefully there'll be a lot more U.S. Opens in my future, and missing this one will not really matter at all. And that's why I skipped it. And, I don't regret that at all. And hopefully I'll play a few U.S. Opens soon.
Were the sponsorship opportunities in terms of financial opportunities, Were they so much so that you said, wow, what am I doing here?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it was more of the playing opportunities that I was hopefully going to get that were really enticing, just because, that's what you really want. You need a place to play, and the opportunity to play a bunch of PGA Tour events was really great. And, it's nice to make some money too, but playing in PGA Tour events is, really where you make your money and get status, and that's what I wanted to do.
Okay, so then we go from the PGA Tour to, at the beginning of last year, your status was on the McKenzie Tour, which is the Canadian PGA Tour. Would you describe that as a level below what is now the Korn Ferry Tour? So there's the McKenzie Tour, then the Korn Ferry, then the PGA Tour?
Yes, that's how it works.
So that was your status going into last year, or this season, rather. And then all of a sudden, yep, Lo and behold, I flip on the TV to the Rocket Mortgage, and I see a very familiar name climbing up the leaderboard. You had a big payday. You had a great finish, solo second. Number one, what did that feel like to all of a sudden go, wow, okay, I've been a little vindicated here?
Yeah, I think that was great. I had played well earlier in the season in Charlotte at the Wells Fargo. I was in the top 10 there for a long time, kind of until the last five or six holes, ended up finishing 18th. So I knew I could do it. And, to really finish strong in Detroit was really great. But I guess, I always knew I could play with these guys, and it just showed everyone I could.
PGA professional, former U.S. amateur champ, and got his start playing NJGA events right here in the Carolinas. Doc Redman is our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the things that high finish got you was a trip over to Scotland or to Northern Ireland to play in the Open Championship this past summer. And in a way, you turned down the chance to play in the Open with your U.S. amateur win. So you got to finally play in the Open Championship. Talk to me about that experience, that golf course. Doc, I got to tell you, on TV, it looked like one of the most amazing tracks you'd ever want to play.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny. I never played any links golf over there ever, so I have nothing to compare it to, but I loved it. The fans were awesome. The setup was incredible. It's just so different from what we play every day. And there were so many different, it could play totally different from where the wind was to if it rained, how firm it was, and just kind of how the greens weren't, as fast as we're used to. But I loved every minute of it. It was funny to that point. I'd hoped when I turned down the Open two summers ago that, I'd play in a lot, but never would have thought that I would have made my first one this season. So that was pretty awesome.
Now, not having any links golf experience, did you use your normal caddy, or did you pick up a caddy when you were over there?
I took a caddy from who caddies on the European Tour, who had caddied there a few times just for some help, and then took my coach, our assistant coach at Clemson, over too, just to help me prep and get used to kind of the different conditions, different turf, and I think all of those really helped me a lot.
Well, yeah, you had a top 20 finish, which for someone who's never played links golf is amazing to me. What were the biggest differences for you in terms of getting used to playing in a way that you perhaps have never played before? What was it that you, a shot or two that you normally wouldn't play that you had to play a lot?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the main things I did was I went to a lower bounce on my wedge just because, for chipping purposes, just because the turf is so firm, and even when it rains, you know, it's really, really firm. And then the other thing is just kind of thinking about the bounces you're going to get and how much it's going to roll out, especially on tee shots. You know, some might be 320 out, but if it's a little downwind, you know, you're really only trying to hit it 240 maybe, you know.
Is that hard to wrap your head around when, you know, you know how long the hole is and you're looking at your caddy and he says, you know, hey, mate, let's do this only about 220 yards. And you're going, wait a minute, this hole's 520. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it was pretty wild. And it was just, like I said, interesting to see how, you know, we got a few different winds. Even in a day, holes would play wildly different, you know, in a matter of 15 minutes. And any time, really any hole that was into the wind was almost the hardest hole on the course, no matter what it was.
As you look back, I imagine you're able to go, you know, this was really cool or this was really fun. At the time, are you able to step outside your body and go, look at how really cool this is. This is a lot of fun. Or are you just like, oh, my God, this is hell on earth. I can't believe we're trying to do this.
No, I think I had a blast the whole time. And, you know, one of the things I did was at the Open, I doubled the first hole. And, you know, right after that, it was funny, my caddy, I two-putted from like 60 feet. My caddy said, you know, that's going to be your biggest two-putt of the week. And I was like, listen, that's a horrible start, obviously, but I'm just going to have fun with it this week. You know, I'm over here. This is my first time. And whatever happens, happens. Just have fun. And ended up playing, you know, pretty nice the whole week. And I enjoyed every second of it.
Well, and look at that, a double bogey on one. Well, you beat Rory by two on that first hole. You were in the lead in the head-to-head.
Yeah, that hole was sneaky, very difficult.
Doc Redman is a PGA Tour professional, former U.S. amateur champ. Got his start playing amateur golf right here in the Carolinas with NJGA events. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. Sort of catch us up as to where you are now, your status for this year. What are the plans for Doc Redman this first part of the 2019-2020 season?
Yeah, so I've got a full status on the PGA Tour now, and we're on our fourth event of the fall, so I'm in Vegas right now, just getting ready for the Shriners Hospital Open at TPC Summerlin, and just playing out here on tour and enjoying it and trying to play the best I can.
From earlier this fall, that's PGA Tour Pro Doc Redman. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer and Stuart Sink's caddy, Kip Henley, for their time and insight this week. Hey, a reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BePod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook, search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings on in and around the game. And weather-wise, well, looks like we could be dodging some bad weather at the beginning of the weekend, but better towards the end of the weekend as far as teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.